Finish with Hamiltonian mechanics today, and so we have discussed many things. We have discussed Hamilton's equations, we have discussed the freedom in the Hamiltonian description, and you know how the canonical transformations can be exploited to recast the theory in such a crazy and nice thing, for example, as the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And then we briefly discussed integrability, and that's, you know, a story on its own. And you can read many books about integrability, and you can study, you know, the perturbations of integrable systems and so on. But that you know, it can lead very, very far. So last thing I would like to discuss in this basic Hamiltonian description is the constraints. So probably part E. And I will not prove anything. I will not explain anything, basically. I'll just give you some hints, and then you will think about this a little bit more in tomorrow's tutorial. So there are constraints in real life, and the constraints may be a result of your choice of the description of the system, or they may be actually be there, but usually they are because you have chosen some kind of description of the system. So for example, if you have a pendulum, then if I describe the pendulum in Cartesian coordinates x and y, then I still, well, the pendulum doesn't change the length, so I still need to impose the constraint that x squared plus y squared is equal to l squared, the length of my pendulum. So that's an example. So you would be describing things as a system with 2 degrees of freedom, but then you have a constraint. But of course, there's a clever, more clever way to do it. You say, well, I don't use x and y, but instead I just use the angle phi, and then I have system with 1 degree of freedom, and then I don't have a constraint. So anyway, so let's assume that, so let not all qi and pi be independent. So that means that at any instant of time, I have a constraint phi qi pi equals to 0. And that's constraint. And it's valid for any instant of time. Okay. So that's basically a definition of what you mean by constraint. So just a side remark. So you know that in some sense, any phase space function can be thought of as a Hamiltonian. So remark. Any function f can be thought of as a Hamiltonian. In other words, it will actually generate like time translation in some fictitious time lambda, given by, so if I take, let's say, derivative of the coordinates, but it can be any function here. And so this is my fictitious time. Which is in which corresponds to this Hamiltonian evolution, and so this is given by the Poisson bracket of Q. This is my function, which I now understand as a Hamiltonian. So now, okay. So yeah. But this is the fictitious time corresponding to this Hamiltonian here, and this is just the time evolution. Okay, so now you know that specifically the conserved quantities, so specifically conserved quantity is a quantity which Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian, with the real Hamiltonian. So it's defined, so conserved quantity I, or integral of motion I, is defined to have I of h equal to 0. So this is equal to 0. It's my definition of what I mean by conserved quantity. So now of course, this is anti-symmetric operation, so I can switch the two. So it's minus h of I, which is precisely this thing here. So you are evolving now the Hamiltonian with respect to this fictitious time lambda. Okay. And so this equation tells you that actually, because this is equal to zero, and the Hamiltonian does not evolve.
I don't see
yeah, how we're evolving.
I'm not really sure why you're writing that. Could you?
Okay. So the first statement is just a definition of what you mean by conserved quantity.
Great.
Okay. The second thing is just a mathematical identity because Poisson brackets are antisymmetric. And then I'm writing a okay, so this was a stupid thing. So let's not do it for QI, let's do it for any function G, right? So what I was trying to say here is that I can think of any function as some kind of Hamiltonian, and then this function will generate some kind of evolution with respect to some fictitious time. So now I'm just using this for this guy here. So
the function is your integral
of okay.
Does it make sense now?
Yeah.
Okay, so what it actually means, so now you know that dh along this fictitious time, along this fictitious flow generated by my integral of motion, actually doesn't change. So Hamiltonian, this means that Hamiltonian is not affected by the flow generated by I. By my integral of motion I. Okay, so this is what it means.
Just when you say the flow generated by I, do you mean this kind of
time evolution?
Okay.
Yeah. So you know, yeah. So it's any function it'll be very clear in half an hour.
Okay.
But okay, so for any function I just, you know, prescribe the corresponding time evolution, and the time evolution sort of moves you, you know, in this time through my phase space. Okay, so now if you have conserved quantity, this leaves Hamiltonian unaffected. But of course, this is precisely what you mean by symmetry. So if, you know, if Hamiltonian is unaffected by some transformation in phase space, this is the symmetry, right? So this gives a symmetry. Is symmetry of the system. So now, of course, this rings the bell, and it's nothing else than Noether's theorem, right? So I have a symmetry, and I have conserved quantity. But you can think about it this way. So, however, if you look at the definition of the constraint, I am saying, well, this thing is equal to zero for any time. So what it actually means is that a constraint is also a conserved quantity. Constraint is also a conserved quantity because it's the same for any time, conserved quantity. It is equal to zero. It's also a conserved quantity. And that means it should also correspond to some kind of symmetry in the system. So, and it corresponds to implies the presence of symmetry, certain symmetry in the system. Okay, so that's just, maybe it's very confusing, but yeah. So if you have constraints, on one hand, you know, you may have some constraints, but that means that there is a corresponding symmetry in the system. Okay. So now, there is a very general procedure how to recognize that the system actually has a constraint. and is discussed by Dirac, and I'm not going to do it here. So to recognize that there is a constraint in the system, use something which was developed by Dirac, Dirac's procedure. So for us, it will be just very simple. We will physically, intuitively find the constraint, or we will just play with the equation and find the constraint. But there is a procedure which gives you there's a precise, you know, prescription how to find that, that there are some constraints in my system that perhaps I have not chosen. You know, I was not clever enough to choose the angle for my pendulum, but I chose x and y, and that was a stupid idea. And then I have constraint x squared plus y squared equals to l squared.
That means, like, if I choose x, y, and z to describe my pendulum, mm-hmm. I would also add by hand a constraint equation. What you're saying is that I wouldn't have to recognize this constraint, and it would already be contained and like.
Well, it depends what you would start with. So if you are clever enough, yeah, you immediately impose the constraint x squared plus y squared equals to l squared. Yeah. Yeah.
But if I don't do that, how is the system going to
Well,
talking about a pendulum? Like,
well, yeah. So in this case, you have to prescribe that. But in more complicated cases, it's, you know, well, you will see an explicit example tomorrow, okay, where actually it's not clear that there's a constraint in the system, but the constraint is there.
Okay.
And so you know, you may just start with some presume that you are given a Lagrangian, and then the question is, you know, is this a constrained system? Are there any constraints in the system? And usually, if you look at the Lagrangian, if you see that some quantities, for example, some generalized coordinates, are not true coordinates, meaning that, for example, the Lagrangian depends only on, let's say, x, but it doesn't depend on x dot, then usually this indicates there's some kind of constraint in the system. But yeah, if you want, read Dirac's book. It's actually a very nice book. It's 50 pages long or something like that. And it has everything you need to know about constraints. Okay, so let's not do this here. But instead, I'll give you a prescription how to deal with constraints. So to deal with constraints, you use the method of Lagrange multipliers. And again, I'm not going to derive anything here. I'll just state this because you have probably seen this in some analysis course or something like that. So use the method of Lagrange multipliers. So basically what it means is that instead of considering the Hamiltonian which was given to you, you consider a so-called a total Hamiltonian, which is your original Hamiltonian, and then you sum over all possible constraints. So if you have, you know, more than one, let's say you have m constraints, then you add to your Hamiltonian. So this is the original Hamiltonian. And this is called total Hamiltonian. And so that's the prescription how to make the total Hamiltonian out of the original one. And so these lambda I's are called Lagrange multipliers. And in general, they are arbitrary functions of time. So lambda I is a function of time. So they are arbitrary functions. Okay. And so once you write down this total Hamiltonian, so in my analysis course, I've seen this for Lagrangian. But for Hamiltonian, it's exactly the same thing. So for Lagrangian, it would be, again, adding lambda I and the constraints. So for Hamiltonian, exactly the same thing. Okay.
And we are not saying that those constraints are zero.
Here, okay, so it's a very good thing. So here you would be putting the left-hand side on here, and then only, so you'd be sort of like off-shell of these constraints. You'd be saying, I am putting this explicit expression for the constraint, then I get my new Hamiltonian. I derive the equations of motion from this total Hamiltonian instead from my original Hamiltonian, and then afterwards, I can impose that these constants are equal to zero once I have written the equations of motion. Okay, so, and then write equations of motion using HT instead of H, and then impose the constraints in the end. Okay, so now funny business happens here because you edit M arbitrary functions here, then the solution, of course, of your equations of motion, well, the equations of motion contain these lambda I. And so given the initial conditions, Q0 and P0, the solution of the equations of motion is not unique because it depends on these lambda I's. Okay, so solution of equations of motion is not unique. Depends on arbitrary lambda I, if you want. But interestingly, what it means is that even if you have non-unique solution, and so choosing one lambda I, I will have something, and choosing another lambda I, I will have something else, the endpoint configurations, of course, describe the same physics. So the physics is unique. Okay? Physics is unique. Thanks. Is unique. And the final configurations, you know, choosing one lambda I or another lambda I or so on, actually are connected by the symmetry corresponding to the presence of these constraints. So configurations for different lambda I's are connected by the symmetry. So in other words, what it means is that you have sort of chosen some description of the system which has constraints. And in the end, using this description, you find that, you know, the solution of equations is not unique, but the physics will be unique. So the physics, you can still make the physical predictions, and you will think about it in tomorrow's tutorial, how to make it.
Don't you now have the QIs and the PIs as functions of D and the lambda I's, and you still have your constraints, so can't you just like...
In some sense, yes, yeah. You can play with the constraints, and you can sort of eliminate these lambda I's in the end, yeah. But that actually sort of corresponds to choosing a particular gauge choice, particular, you know, I'm really choosing now a unique description in some sense.
Why are your constraints satisfied when you just minimize this?
No, they are not. You have to impose that they are satisfied in the end.
Yes, which means you're choosing certain lambda I.
Yeah, if you want. Yeah. If you want. Yeah. But that actually is already some kind of gauge fixing in some sense. So you may be working with this Hamiltonian, containing arbitrary functions, and, you know, writing down the solutions, they will have arbitrary lambda I, and I'm saying, you know, choosing one lambda I or choosing another lambda I, it doesn't matter. The physical description is unique. Okay, so now...
We only request that in the endpoints, all the lambda I's are equal.
At the endpoints. Why they would have to be equal?
I don't know. I thought I heard that.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
So typical origin of constraints, of constraints is, for example, in physics, is that you may be doing something which is not nice. So for example, you decide you want to go from the Lagrangian description to the Hamiltonian description through the Legendre transformation. So e.g., so it's, for example, if you want to go from Lagrangian to Hamiltonian formulation, and so you need to define the generalized momentum. Okay. And so in order to write your Hamiltonian, this equation has to have an inversion. So you have to be able to write qi dot as a function of p. Okay. And so if this doesn't have an inversion, then you have a problem. Does not have an inversion. Because it's some kind of degenerate thing. So in other words, and this happens, for example, when if you take this thing here, qi dot and dqj dot, understand it as a matrix, and you calculate the determinant of this matrix, then you'll find it's actually a degenerate matrix. So if this is true, then you'll find, well, yeah. So if this happens, then this does not have an inversion. You have some zeros in this matrix, zero eigenvalues. And then this will not typically have inversion, and then you are screwed up. Okay. So you will study a toy example, which is the simplest possible example you can think about. But it's interesting property about this example is that it precisely mimics what happens in gravity, what happens in electromagnetism if you consider field theory, and so on. So it's a beautiful example. And let me just give you the results of that, and you will study it in your tutorial. So toy example. So you consider the Lagrangian 1/2 m and then dx over capital T square. So this is my free particle. And T, if you want, is an inertial time. So it's a nice Newtonian time, where your Lagrangian is written in such a nice form. So now what may happen is that you have some other time, which is a lousy time. So for example, your clock doesn't go very well. And so this is some arbitrary function of your inertial time. So for example, your clock goes a little bit faster, then it goes a little bit slower, and so on. So now, of course, you can rewrite the Lagrangian in terms of this lousy time, t. And the Lagrangian becomes more complicated, but you can still do it. I'm just changing one time to another time. Okay, and then you can try to go to the Hamiltonian picture from here. So, you know, write L in this form. And then if you try to go to the Hamiltonian, so Legendre transformation, and you go to the Hamiltonian, then you find something very interesting, that the Hamiltonian is equal to zero. So now, in this lousy time, there is no time evolution generated by the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is identically equal to zero. But you find a constraint, and the constraint is actually equal to pt, the momentum with respect to, and then plus px squared over 2m. So what it means is that, of course, the total Hamiltonian is not equal to zero using this prescription. And you have some kind of evolution with respect to this total Hamiltonian. And then it will be up to you to actually make sense of this and to extract physical results out of this.
What's
PT? It's a momentum with respect. Okay. You will see that. So it's a momentum with respect to this time. So now you take big T, capital T, as a new coordinate in some sense, which is a function of small t. And then this is the corresponding generalized momentum. And so systems which have the Hamiltonian equal to zero are called totally constrained systems. And so this free fall, this free motion of a particle is an example, is just using Lousy time, but typical systems are like this, are gravity, relativistic particle, and so on. So you have many, so you have examples, you know, in mechanics, relativistic particle, but you have also examples in field theory. Okay, so you know, I hope this is just an introduction, and it probably doesn't make any sense. But once you see that example, and then try to solve it on your own, then maybe it will become more sensible what's going on here. Okay, better not questions. So chapter 4, geometric formulation. Mechanics. So far, I hope this was just a repetition in some sense, and you have seen probably this in your undergraduate and or maybe graduate course on classical mechanics. So now let's recast this in a new language, and let's see how beautiful it is once you use the description of differential geometry. So part A is the symplectic geometry okay, and let me start with a definition. So you say that two n-dimensional manifold M, okay, so let M to n be an even dimensional manifold then you say a symplectic structure on M is a closed and non-degenerate two-form omega. Okay, so closed, what it means closed, it's simple, right? So closed means that d of omega equals to zero. And non-degenerate means that if you consider it as a matrix, it has the full matrix rank. So non-degenerate, in mathematical language, some people like mass here. So it means that for all vector fields, which are not equal to zero, there's always another vector field y, so that omega x and y is not equal to zero. Okay, so omega is a two-form, likes to eat vectors, so because it's two, so it eats two vectors, so and it produces a number. So now I'm saying if it eats two vectors, that for all such this, there is at least one y, so that this is not trivial. Okay, so the matrix rank of omega is full. Okay, so this is omega is called a symplectic structure, and the pair m to 2n and omega is called a symplectic manifold. So in other words, symplectic manifold is just a manifold which is equipped with a two form. Okay? Very special two form. So that's the end of the definition. Nobody can argue with definition, so this is definition, so that's probably okay. So now a few remarks. So the first remark is, in some sense, the existence of a non-degenerate two-form on a manifold, it actually means that the manifold has to be even-dimensional. So omega is non-degenerate, then dimension of M is 2n. So it cannot be that you have three-dimensional manifold and you would have a non-degenerate two-form there. In some sense, if you think about a two-form which is completely anti-symmetric matrix, then it will always have, in odd-dimensional space, it will always have one eigenvalue which is equal to 0. So omega is degenerate. Okay. Second, having omega, so this omega, of course, I can write as omega alpha beta, and then, dx alpha dx beta, dx alpha 1/2, dx alpha dx beta. So these are the coordinates of my omega components. These are the components of omega in the given coordinate system. So then you can define another object capital omega, which is defined by an inverse of omega understood in components as a matrix. So this is a matrix inverse of this small omega. Okay? So you're defining new object capital omega by a matrix inverse of this small omega. Okay. Now, because small omega is non-degenerate, the inverse is unique. There is no non-uniqueness in this definition. So omega alpha beta is unique. So now, what is funny thing is that now when you have these two objects, you can sort of map Tm to T star of m. So can use this to connect the tangent vector space over M with the cotangent vector space over M. So we know that in tangent vector space there are some vectors, and in cotangent vector space there are forms. Okay, so let me give you an example. So omega will actually map vectors to forms according to a prescription. So you take a vector and you assign this thing here. So I take a vector and I have a form evaluated in the first slot on the vector. So it still is, this second spot is free. So this object likes to eat one more vector and gives you a number. Okay, but object which likes to eat one more vector and gives a number is a form. So this thing actually is a member of T star of M. Okay, and so in components this is very simple. So I start with a vector x alpha, and I assign to it a one form which I call, let's call it x beta. It's just nothing else than x alpha omega alpha beta. Okay. So now this is the components of the vector. These are the components of a one form, and this is how I do it. Okay. So similarly, you can use the other object to go from the other way. So now you can do from T star of M to Tm. So you take a one form and you do omega eta, so, or in components, eta alpha. you go to eta beta, which is now index up, and then it's omega beta alpha beta alpha. Okay, so now you have these maps. So now this should be familiar if you have taken any course on relativity. So well, what we are effectively doing here is rising or lowering indices of the objects. Okay, and you did that before, rising or lowering indices. And you did that previously using the metric, and that's possible. But here I give you another example how to rise or lower indices using the symplectic form. Okay, questions to this? It's very simple. All is very simple, right? So, remark number three. So, given a function f on my symplectic manifold, then I can use omega to define a corresponding vector field. Omega defines, and this vector field is very special vector field. It's generated by this function f. It's called Hamiltonian vector field. It defines a Hamiltonian vector field. It's basically a definition of the Hamiltonian vector field, if you want. So you get a vector which depends on this function f. And you define this to be, well, you have two options. You take either this omega here and dot it, or make a contraction with the differential of f, or this is equivalent to taking an inner product with small omega to be equal to minus df. So for any function, you can define the corresponding vector field by this thing here. Okay, so why the two prescriptions are equivalent? It's very simple. So let's do it in coordinates. That's probably the most familiar and simple way. So x, f, alpha. So what you are saying here is, so this will have components omega, alpha, beta, and then the components of a differential is just the partial derivative of my function. So it's dx beta of f. So this is the first thing. And now I'm saying this is equivalent to the other thing. So what you need to do is that you need to multiply this thing by, you need to lower the index through omega. Okay, so you are saying here you have xf alpha omega alpha gamma, it's this thing here. So what it is, so it's this thing here, it's omega alpha gamma omega alpha beta dx beta on f. Okay, so now if you look at what these things are, there's a contraction over alpha here, which is almost what I use as a definition. So if I write big omega first and then small omega second, that it's almost that definition what I mean by omega and capital omega. But of course, this thing is antisymmetric in alpha and beta, as is small alpha and beta. So this is minus delta beta gamma dx beta. And so this delta will just change this index to gamma. So it's minus d gamma of f, which is precisely this relation here. So indeed, the two relations are equivalent, and you can use whichever definition you want. And this is true because small omega and capital omega are both non-degenerate and then well-defined. Okay, Very simple. So, you know, in this language, everything is very simple. Okay. So now, a theorem. The theorem about the cat again. So we had a Liouville's theorem. But let's write it in, you know, in two steps. So the first step will be a Hamiltonian vector field, which is defined here, preserves the symplectic structure. So what do you mean by that is that by preserving or not preserving, you are talking about the Lie derivative. So the statement is that the Lie derivative of my omega with respect to this Hamiltonian vector field generated by any function f is equal to zero. Okay.
About the last thing you said there, what exactly is anti-symmetric there?
Oh, so omega is a small omega is a two form.
Yes.
So if I understand, if I talk about the components of omega, they are antisymmetric, right? If I swap the two indices, they are antisymmetric. So then I define capital omega also antisymmetric by this definition here. And so, you know, in order to use that definition here, I would have to have omega beta alpha omega alpha gamma. But in order to do that, I have to swap the two indices here. And yeah, so I'm picking up that minus sign over there. Thanks for that question. Okay, so that's the theorem. Of course, to prove this theorem is very, very simple. So let's calculate what it is. So proof. Well, what it is equal to, Lx of f acting on omega. Now you are using the Cartan's lemma. So it is x of f acting on d omega plus d of x of f acting on omega due to the Cartan's lemma. Which we are already familiar with. So now d omega is equal to zero by definition. Okay, so that thing is gone. And xf acting on omega is minus df. So you have d square acting on f, but d square acting on anything is equal to zero. Okay, so this is equal to zero, and you prove the theorem. Okay, so you know, for any phase space function on a symplectic manifold, you can define this vector field x. And this vector field x is nice vector field, meaning that actually it will not change the symplectic structure. It will preserve the symplectic structure on that. It's constructed in such a way, basically, that it preserves the symplectic structure. Okay, so as a consequence, so the Liouville theorem said that basically the volume on the phase space doesn't change in time as you do canonical transformations or as you do time evolution or canonical transformations. So now, what actually is the volume element on the phase space? It can be shown that it's a product of these symplectic structures. And you will see it in coordinates in 10 minutes that it is actually so. So Liouville theorem says a Hamiltonian vector flow, or vector field preserves the volume element on the phase space volume element on M. And so this volume element is defined to be a skew symmetric product of these symplectic forms, and you have n of them. So it's 1 over n factorial and omega wedge, and so on, wedge omega, and there is n of those products. So you call this form a volume element, which will be apparent. Basically, what it is just dq1 to dqn, dp1 to dpn, and there's wedges in between them. And so this is really, you know, how to measure the volume of this manifold. And so this is preserved. So proof again is very simple. Proof. So you want to calculate Lxf acting on epsilon, which is, of course, 1 over n factorial. And then you act on this product. But you know that the Lie derivative satisfies the Leibniz rule. So you can act on this guy and then leave the other guys untacked and act on that guy and so on. But of course, all the guys are the same. So you will have n same terms, which all look like this thing. So let's forget about 1 over n factorial. But let's write the first term, Lxf acting on omega, and then wedge. And then wedge omega, and there's n minus 1 of these things. And the other terms are precisely like that. So, but we proved that this guy is 0 in your previous theorem, so this must be equal to 0.
Why are all the omegas the same? Like, don't they correspond to each, like, index of the, like, shouldn't they be indexed with the coordinates?
So, omega is a 2 form, so what you can do. So let's say I had another term. I had a term like omega wedge Lx omega and then wedge other thing. So now you can take this thing and you can bring it to the front, right? So you are jumping a 2 form. So if you...
No, okay. My question is more like you want a volume element in the phase space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was something like dx1 wedge dp1
exactly
dx2. So then omega, aren't omega the 2 forms, like dx1 wedge dp1? So then omega should be like omega 1 wedge omega 2 wedge omega 3, like corresponding to the indices of coordinates.
Can you remember this question? And you know it should be apparent in 10 minutes.
Yeah,
sure. Okay. There was another question. The same question. Okay, so should be apparent in 10 minutes. Okay, so that's remark 3. So I'm saying, you know, this thing which is defined over here is actually preserved under the Hamiltonian field. Okay, so remark number 4 is that if you have 2 functions on M, so given two functions, then omega also defines their Poisson bracket. And so this Poisson bracket is now defined as F and G. And you can use it again. You can define it using small omega or big omega, doesn't matter. So let me write both things. So you take differentials of F and G, and you contract them with capital omega, or there's this annoying minus sign. You take small omega, and you take the corresponding vector fields and evaluate this omega on these vector fields. So this is how you define a Poisson bracket. So now it's up to you. So when I gave you the definition of omega, well, of the Poisson bracket in the standard formulation, I gave you first, you know, a precise prescription for the Poisson bracket, which was df over dq, dg over dp, and so on. And then you could show some properties out of there using the properties of the derivatives. So now it's a challenge for you if you want to do it. It's no time to do it here or in tutorial, but you can show that, you know, such thing has all the properties of the Poisson bracket as you know it. So this is, you know, linear, anti-symmetric, satisfies Leibniz, and satisfies Jacobi identity from here. So all the properties which we are sort of using yesterday as a definition of the Poisson bracket come from this definition as well. So now linearity is probably obvious. Antisymmetry just comes from the fact that this guy is antisymmetric or that guy is antisymmetric. So this is also almost obvious. Leibniz, well, you can do it. So now do you know which property I need to use so that I show the Jacobi identity? There must be some property about omega, right? So which property this could be related to? Ah, very good. So this is precisely to the property that d omega equals to zero. So that's a three-line calculation. If you want to do it, you can do it. It's interesting and illuminating to show that d omega equals to zero is completely equivalent to the fact that Poisson bracket defined in this way satisfies the Jacobi identity. Okay. You have this definition. You can also show things like, I'll just write it here, whatever I'm writing in the text. So this is a nice property, but we will not really use it anywhere. So if I take a Hamiltonian vector field generated by a new function, which is a Poisson bracket of f and g, then I claim that this is exactly equal to a commutator of these vector fields here. So a Lie bracket or whatever. So there's a connection between Poisson brackets and Lie brackets, as you know them, or a commutator. But yeah, it's not really important for us at this point. So finally, to answer your question and your question, let us specify, you know, let us look at these expressions in some very nice coordinates. Okay, so far this was basically invariant, and we didn't need to invoke anything about coordinates, but sometimes coordinates are useful. So remark number five, there is something which is called Darboux theorem. And basically, what it says is that if you have a non-degenerate two-form, and in our case it is closed as well, so omega is closed and non-degenerate, and so on, so then there exists a coordinate system and let me call the coordinates, well, x alpha, my coordinates on my manifold M, but let's split them into two, qi and then pi, okay? And such that our capital omega or small omega has the simplest possible form you can think about antisymmetric matrix. And that is, so zeros everywhere and plus minus ones on around the diagonal. Okay, so for example, omega alpha beta, if you understand it as a matrix, then you will have 0, 1, minus 1, 0, one block, other block 0, 1, minus 1, 0 here. And so this is the coordinate q1, And this is the coordinate p1, q1, and then p1, and then q2, and p2, and so on. And finally, qn, pn is this form here. And zeros everywhere else. So that's the simplest possible form of your omega. So now the same thing, of course, is true for small omega. But again, the annoying sign, so now you flip the signs here. So you'll have instead of plus one, minus one, the other way around. So you'll have 0, minus 1, plus 1, 0, 0, minus 1, plus 1, 0. Okay? So in these coordinates, your omega is the simplest possible one you can think about. Or if you don't want to write it in components, you can just write that omega is dpi wedge dqi, which is dp1 dq1 plus dpn dqn. Okay, so this is what omega is. I don't know if it corresponds to what you thought omega is. It must be non-degenerate, right? So the, if I take this as a matrix, it really has to have all eigenvalues which are non-trivial. And so this is that. So it cannot have just one block here and zeros everywhere else, because that would be degenerate. It has to have the full matrix rank. And yeah, so this is the simplest form you can write anti-symmetric matrix in some sense. Okay, so this is the form of your omega. And using these coordinates, it's easy to see that really what I claim epsilon to be a volume form indeed is a volume form. So let me do an example on, well, let's say in two dimensions. So in these coordinates, it's A, easy to see that epsilon is indeed a volume form. So for example, let me take just an example where I have just two dimensions, so n equal to 2. So we have omega, which is dp1 dq1 plus dp2 wedge dq2. So now if you write what epsilon is, 1 over 2 omega wedge omega, well, 1 over 2, well, this wedge that. dp1 wedge dq1 plus dp2 wedge dq2 wedge dp1 dq1 plus dp2 wedge dq2. Well, what it is? So if I take this term with that term, well, it's of course identically zero because I have dp1 here and dp1 here, so it doesn't contribute. So this is equal to 1/2, and I have dp1 wedge dq1, and I have to take the second term, which is non-trivial contribution, wedge dp2 wedge dq2, plus zero. And then if I take the other term here, I can take this one with that one, that's okay. So it's plus dp2 wedge dq2 wedge dp1 wedge dq1. But if I take this guy with that guy, it gives me zero again. Okay. So now, if you stare at these things and use, you know, flop, well, which form I wanted to get? I want to get p1, q1. So let's say I take this guy and put it here. So I jump a one form twice, I pick up no sign, and this guy I put over that, and again, no sign here. So this is equal to dp1, dq1, wedge dp2, wedge dq2. Okay? So now how you integrate forms is simply, so if I have a form, if you want to integrate a function over the phase space, then this is defined in the form language as you take that function and product with the volume form. And so this is f times dp1, dq1, and then dp2, dq2, and so on, dpn, dqn. Okay, so now you see that you have all these of all possible coordinates, and you just define this to be a Lebesgue integral of f dp1, dpn, dq1, dqn. Okay, so this is just by definition what you mean. Integral over a 2n form, you just define it by a Lebesgue integral. So this is a definition. Okay, so now you see that really this gives you the volume form on your manifold. Okay. So that's fine. So we have a volume form. Second property which you can see from here is what is your Poisson bracket now? So your Poisson bracket, Poisson bracket now takes a canonical form. And so if you look over here, so df omega dg, but omega has precisely this form here, then it just reduces to whatever you know from your standard definition. So f of g, which is omega alpha beta d alpha f d beta g from over here. But now omega alpha beta is either 0 or 1, but it's only 0 of 1. Wait, well, OK. So this is df over dq I dg over dpi minus, and that's the other way around. So it's minus dg over dqi and df over dpi. So this is the Poisson bracket as you know it. So the canonical Poisson bracket you get out of here only when you use these special Darboux coordinates for your symplectic form. Questions? So people, you know, when you are given a symmetric matrix, people are familiar how to diagonalize that symmetric matrix. You bring it in the form when you have on the diagonal, you have the eigenvalues or whatever. Or you can actually set the eigenvalues equal to 1 up to a signature. So for example, that's why your flat space metric has signature minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1 on the diagonal. So now doing the Darboux coordinate, it's precisely doing that, but now for an antisymmetric matrix. And people are less familiar with antisymmetric matrices than with symmetric matrices. But again, this is linear algebra first year, right? OK, so we have 10 minutes to talk about Hamiltonian mechanics. So this is symplectic geometry, and all you need to know about symplectic geometry. And so how does this apply to mechanics? And the applications to mechanics is very, very straightforward if you want to. So part B. Hamiltonian mechanics revised. And so you have to, yes?
So are the coordinates given to you by the Darboux theorem the same thing as like action angle variables?
Well, something like that. Something like that. But you know, this is nothing to do basically about, you know, any physics. It's just a mathematical statement. I can always skew diagonalize my anti-symmetric matrix, and that's basically it. Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, if you want to think about, yeah, there'll be application to, yeah, in some sense, yes. Okay, so let me start with basic definitions. Basic definitions. So the first is configuration space. Let's call it C. For a system with n degrees of freedom, is just an n-dimensional manifold. And okay, well, maybe not. Configuration system for a system with n degrees of freedom is an n-dimensional manifold, and then you can introduce local coordinates on that manifold or local chart. And you have coordinates q1 to qn. Okay. This is of course again the consequence of the Darboux theorem, if you want. But anyway, so let's define it this way. So what I mean by that, so now you have really a motion on the manifold. So motion on the manifold. So a point on the manifold is just where you start. So this corresponds to a position q0 at time equal to 0. So configuration at t equal to t0. Let's say this is my final configuration. So configuration at t equal to, well, at t equal to t final. And then in the meantime, I have this curve which connects the two points on the manifold. And so let's call this curve delta t, which is the trajectory of the system in that manifold, trajectory. And of course, it corresponds to time evolution. So now each point on this curve is just a photo of the system. So point on delta t just describes how the system looked like at that given time. Okay. So if I'm here, this is the photo of the system. So configuration space is an n-dimensional manifold where the motion happens. Okay, that's very intuitive. Now, what is a phase space? So you remember that the phase space had also the momenta. It had not only the coordinates, but it also the momenta. So momentum is a one form. So you want to build some kind of fiber bundle over your manifold. And it cannot be the tangent bundle because that would be the velocity. Right? You have vectors in tangent bundle. You have velocities in the tangent bundle. So for phase space, you have to have a one form, so cotangent bundle. So phase space is cotangent bundle over cotangent bundle over C. So D star of C. Okay, so that's what a phase space is. Yes?
I never understood like why you can't just kind of like flip the, like why does momentum have to be a one form and why can't like you flip momentum and position and just like do everything dual and have like the same kind of.
Exactly. It's very complicated.
Or
Well, maybe you'll see now. Never, but you're right. To be confused, it's correct to be confused here because, yeah. Yeah. So let me do it this way. So let me do it, you know, basically I'm starting to build the classical mechanics and then, yeah. So I'm saying, you know, there's a motion in the configuration space, and the configuration space is a manifold, and then I define the phase space to be a cotangent bundle over this. And of course, this has dimension two n, and the local coordinates and coordinates q1, qn, and p1, and then pn. So apart from the positions, I have also the momenta here. Okay, so that's the point. So every point in a cotangent bundle will have these coordinates. Okay, so that's a phase space. So now to answer your question partly, you define something which is called Cartan's form. Okay, so simply a definition, it's denoted by theta, and it's a one form which lives in the phase space. So it's a one form, it means it lives in T star of C. So this is my phase space, and this is a one form living on that phase space. And you define this to be just pj dqj. So it's a one form which lives on the phase space. Okay. So once you have that, this defines a natural symplectic structure. On T star of C, which is just an exterior derivative of this. So you define your omega to be D of theta. Such omega is exact, so it will be also closed. And so if you differentiate this thing, so you just apply D to this guy, and it's just you are taking dpj which dqj. Okay, so this is your symplectic structure. So in some sense, these objects are all well defined. So starting from in a configuration space, I build a phase space as a very special space, right? It's a cotangent bundle. So I have that structure of the cotangent bundle. So I have really 2n coordinates, if you want. I have q1, qn, and then I have coordinates of the momenta here. And so this is very nice space. Cotangent space is very nice space. And so in that space, you can always define this guy, and then you can define that guy. So the fact that you have that the phase space is a cotangent bundle immediately sort of gives you that you can, it's a symplectic manifold. Okay, and this is, you know, obvious that omega is closed, but it's also non-degenerate, right? So this is really fine. Okay, so we have a symplectic structure on this space, and the last thing is to really specify the dynamics, and the dynamics is specified by specifying what the Hamiltonian is. So the dynamics. Dynamics is defined by Hamiltonian Hamiltonian function, which is a function on the phase space, so and gives you a real number. So you have H p1, pn, q1, qn. Okay? So, just a remark, maybe you just see here that I don't put t here. So before we could have h as a function of p and q and t. So here I don't allow that, simply because the symplectic geometry is not good enough to describe Hamiltonians which depend explicitly on time. And you'll have to do some more work to include for time-dependent Hamiltonians, which we'll do tomorrow. So let's just, at this point, there is no t here. Okay. Well, and then we are done. So now we equip the phase space with the Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian generates a vector field, which is called dynamical Hamiltonian vector field, dynamical Hamiltonian vector field, precisely as any symplectic manifold you can do for any function f. So now you just do, dynamical Hamiltonian vector field x sub h. So now this is my function for the vector field, precisely as what we are doing there for arbitrary function f. And so this is defined by x h is omega dh. But what it also is the Poisson bracket, where you leave one slot of that Poisson bracket empty by the definition of the Poisson bracket. And you also know that this is completely equivalent to that xh hook omega is minus dh. Okay. So we have the corresponding dynamical vector field. And if we have the corresponding dynamical vector field, we can find its integral curves. And they define the motion in this phase space. So we have this vector field, and it has integral curves, curve gamma, the function of time, is just what a q and p are as a function of time, pjt and qjt. Okay, so that's my integral curve in the phase space. And so if you write it as an integral curve, and I can write even here, it's great. You say that this vector field x defines what you mean by time evolution. So you just define it to be d over dt. And the tangent curves to it are precisely these integral curves. So it's dqj over dt, d over dqj plus dpj over dt, d over dpj. Okay? So that's just what you mean by integral curve. And we've seen that last week. Okay? So this is just an integral curve. Integral curve is a curve whose tangent is actually the corresponding vector field, right? So this is that. At the same time, you have that definition, what that Hamiltonian vector field it really is. So you know, by definition, you said this is equal to a Poisson bracket with h, okay? But then the Poisson bracket is given here. So in canonical coordinates, so if you use canonical Darboux coordinates, okay, then your Poisson bracket looks like this. So now I'm not filling the first spot. So I'm taking this f to be gone, and I have dot g. So there'll be is a dot here. So there is nothing here, and there is nothing there. Okay. So this is what it is. So this is equal to dh over dpi d over dqi minus dh over dqi d over dpi. Okay. And now I just compare whatever I see standing in front of, okay, let's put j so that it looks exactly the same. So now I compare whatever I see here with whatever I see here. Okay, so you have that dh over dpj is equal to q dqj over dt, which is qj dot. Okay, and then I compare whatever I see here with whatever I see here, and you have that pj dot is minus dh over dqj. Okay? Anybody seen this before? It's just the Hamilton's canonical equations. Okay, so that's a different derivation of Hamilton's canonical equations. So let me stop here maybe.